Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of Cavalytics, a podcast about the NBA's Cleveland Cavaliers with a focus on statistical analysis. We're available on both SoundCloud and iTunes, and we would appreciate likes and good ratings there if you like what we're doing. You can follow us on Twitter at CavalyticsNBA, and you can email us at CavalyticsNBA@gmail.com. I am Keith Carter. I cut my teeth discussing the Cavs online by running a Cavs fan site in the mid-90s. My co-host is Arnav Chabra, and he brings to the podcast obsessive Cavs fandom as well as some world-class numerical analysis knowledge that, quite frankly, seriously overqualifies him for this exercise, but we're thankful to have him. How was your weekend, Arnav?
It was well. It was great. We had an excellent win.
Yeah, big win over the Spurs on Saturday, which we'll definitely get into. Did you see that these Mozgov winter hats are going for like $40 on eBay?
I did see that, yes.
It's pretty interesting because to get into a Cavs game on Flash Seats costs like $20.
So. Yeah. What do you think Mozgov thinks of everyone basically stereotyping him to be one of those, basically one of those polar bear type Russians?
Yeah, the big dumb oaf, Russian dude shtick is getting a little old to my taste.
Right.
But the Cavs marketing department seems to like it. They also did this video about like who the worst roommate would be, and you know, they had every single Cavs said Mozgov, and they're like, oh, he's so big. And yeah, it's a little tiresome, but you know, I don't know if they're gonna change that.
Yeah, whatever sells, you know.
Yeah, whatever makes the money. So let's see. All right, so we have three topics. We're gonna go over the Cavs big win over the Spurs on Saturday. Then we're going to discuss Matthew Dellavedova and his improved play this season. And then we're going to get into Kevin Love a little bit and why we think his contribution is much higher than what you might expect from looking at his more traditional numbers. And I think Arnav has some interesting things there. But all right, you ready, Arnav?
Yes.
Okay. So, on Saturday night, the Cavs beat the San Antonio Spurs by 14, 117-103. At the time, the Spurs had an SRS in the mid-12s, and the Cavs had an SRS around 5. It was somewhere in the high 4s. And just to remind the listeners, SRS stands for Simple Rating System. And essentially, it's the average number of points a team scores more than their opponents per game. However, it's also scaled by strength of opponent, so it's less susceptible to scheduling issues. For example, if you've played, if you've played the 76ers a bunch of times, the 76ers are a bad team, your SRS would be a little bit lower. And just to sort of level set it a little bit, the best SRS of all time was the 1971 Milwaukee Lakers with Kareem and Oscar Robertson, and their season SRS was 11.91. And that's followed closely by the 1996 Bulls, which won 72 games, which is the most ever. And their SRS was 11.8. The Warriors last year were the seventh best SRS of all time with a 10.01. And I forgot to look it up before Saturday night's game, but I believe the Spurs were 12.5. So by SRS, they still are. Their SRS now is 12.11, and they were the best team of all time. So, beating them would be pretty good. Let me just say a couple more things here and then I'll, allow Arnav to respond. Tim Duncan did not play, and his real plus minus is 6.3. Real plus minus is a ESPN proprietary formula that tries to judge how much a player contributes to a team per 100 possessions. RPM and SRS are not the same scale, but they're pretty similar. So if a team has, like the Spurs has an SRS of 12 and they're missing a player that has an RPM of 6, their true talent level was probably significantly lower. And also, the Cavs were at home, and SRS apparently from the literature apparently gives a 3-point advantage to the home team by SRS. So what do you think, Arnav? How big was that win over the Spurs?
I think it was still pretty big, even though Tim Duncan wasn't there. because as he could see, our offense was flowing really well. I don't think it would have made, I don't think the result would have been different. I think probably we would have won by less if Tim Duncan was there. But I think it was really good to see a lot of the adjustments that were made by Tyronn Lue, depending on the flow of the game. Because at some point, you could see Pop going into a zone defense, and then Cavs, they were flustered for a little bit, but then they responded really well, as they should have.
Yeah, the announcers, I was watching the ABC broadcast, and the announcers made note that the Spurs had switched to zone sometime maybe in the second quarter.
Yeah, it was end of the second. I think he started. I think Pop realized that the game was out of hand, so he started experimenting at
Yeah.
some point. Yeah.
What do you think the Cavs were doing that sort of forced them to try a new defense?
Well, I think that they were just making their shots, right? I mean, and I think what Pop realized that if he wasn't going to win this game, he might as well try something against sort of the mini version of the Warriors, because I think his point was that Kyrie is kind of like a mini Steph Curry in the sense that he can do a lot of things that Steph can. So he knows he's going to go against Steph in the Western Conference Finals. So he might as well start experimenting and seeing, trying, throwing different people at Kyrie and see how he responds, just as a practice run for how Steph would respond.
Yeah, well, that, and particularly in the fourth quarter, that strategy. Well, whatever they were trying wasn't working.
Yeah, so I
Kyrie.
think that they threw like Jonathan Simmons at him. That's sort of their new guy that they picked up from the D League, who's
Yeah.
really athletic,
He
but
is.
isn't
He
that
is.
good offensively, so.
Yeah, well, the Spurs have plenty of offense anyway.
Yeah.
How tall is he? Do you know?
It's like just from the game, I think like 6'5", 6'6". He was
Yeah.
pretty tall.
Yeah, he looked, a tiny
He
bit short, but
blocked
Kawhi.
LeBron's, I don't know if it was a block. It looked like a goaltend to me, but at least it was close enough
Well,
where
right, yeah, regardless of
someone has to
whether or
make
not
the
that should
call.
have counted for 2 points, that was a spectacular block he had
It
on
was a really
LeBron.
good block, yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
I think
you.
the best blocks, I don't know if I don't know if everyone noticed, but Manu Ginobili had three blocks on him. That was ridiculous.
On
So Kevin
LeBron.
Love blocked him, Tristan Thompson
Oh,
blocked
blocks
him.
against, yeah. Yeah, Manu looks like a shell of his former self out there, and it's
It's weird because he had an excellent start to the season, but yeah, he's getting back too
yeah,
slowly.
I think he's an interesting guy, but he's got that sort of egregious bald spot, and he just
Right.
he just looks like an old man at this point. And so it's hard to for me at least, it's a little bit hard for me to stop projecting like an old man vibe on him. But yeah, he has looked at least in our two games against them, he's looked like, he really only has 10 or 15 minutes per game to give at this point.
Right. I think at this point, if Tony Parker and Patty Mills for them aren't playing well from the guard spot, they're going to have a lot of issues keeping up with these fast athletic teams.
Yeah, Parker has looked good in the two games against the Cavs. I'm curious. At least he's looked. I don't quite know what the right word here is. He's looked athletic. He's looked fast. I wonder, over a 7-game series, and if the Cavs play the Spurs in the finals, it would basically have been over potentially 14 games, right? Chasing around Steph in the Western Conference Finals, and then chasing around Kyrie
Yeah.
in the
Whew.
NBA Finals. I mean, you can imagine that burning Parker out. On the other hand, in the playoffs, you always get at least one day off, and in the finals, and I think in the conference finals as well, you get 2 days off twice.
Yeah, one or two, yeah.
Yeah, so.
And then presumably they would have swept everyone before that, so. I
Yeah, I don't see the
don't see
Rockets
anyone
or
else giving
Clippers
them
giving
even
them.
a close to a run. Maybe the Clippers probably will give them a run because they're again a bad matchup, but
I mean,
I think the Spurs will win probably
the
this
Clippers
time.
did beat them in seven last year, so
Yeah.
I don't want to dismiss them too quickly. The Clippers are sort of a dysfunctional mess at this point. I mean, yeah, who knows what they're going to be looking like? Look, they may have traded Chris Paul or Blake Griffin by then. Who knows? Okay, well, so anyway, so I think, I th look. So the Cavs win on Saturday was exciting. It was certainly. I mean, I would tell anyone who would listen to me before the game that I thought the Cavs were going to get stomped. It certainly su the result surprised me. I'm trying to figure out how excited I should be. Out of 10, is it like a 3 or is it like a 7? And I think it's like it's like a 4. It's a big win. It showed a lot of promising things. but you know, you got to be careful because I think the Spurs sort of mailed it in the second half, and of course Duncan wasn't playing.
Yeah, I think the most exciting part, though, is that since Tyronn Lue has taken over, our offensive rating has skyrocketed to 115.4 per 100 possessions. So that's where the Cavs were like never going to be, you know, one of the best defensive teams in the NBA. They were always going to be pretty good defensively, but the idea was that they were going to be historically good offensively. And if they can reach that potential, I think they have a much better chance of keeping up with the Spurs in the finals. Up with the Warriors or the Spurs in the finals.
I think that's a good narrative. Okay, so last year, do you remember what the Cavs' second half offensive rating was? It was really high.
Yeah, it was like it was about 109. So they were close to 110.
Okay, and the Cavs are, you said 114 since
115 since Tyronn Lue.
And that includes the loss to.
That includes the loss to Chicago.
Okay, wow.
The problem is defensively, they've kind of dropped off. So they're like 109 defensively.
Huh.
Which is, again, one of the worst. But
well, yeah, so there's two things here. Yeah, there's two things here. If we're going to take encouragement from the improved offensive rating, it's sort of hard to say that we're not going to take discouragement from the defensive rating. However, I'm about to try to do just that. So I think the offensive rating has changed because the Cavs appear to have actually made some changes. There's been much talked about pace and how the Cavs want to improve their pace. Do you want to share what you found about pace?
Yeah, with the pace aspect. So on average, each possession they're not doing it much quicker. So on average, the pace is still kind of the same. And in fact, in some of the games, it's been slower.
Right. So, for example, the Cavs' pace. Well, let me just say really quick. So the Cavs' pace with under Coach Blatt, I think, was around 95, and I think it's like 94.5 or something like that since Lue took over.
Right, so I mean, even in the Spurs game, it was 89.3, so it wasn't much faster. In fact, it was a lot slower, to be honest with you. But the difference, though, now is that off of misses, they're actually running out in transition. So that's the difference that's happening. However, in the half court set, they're still pretty slow. But that was what needed to be changed, is that LeBron and Kyrie are really good in transition, and off of misses, especially when the defense is inside, they can actually be very, very efficient. So before the Cavs were averaging about 12 points in the fast break, and since Lue has taken over, they're averaging 15. So that's three more, not a lot more, but at least they're getting there. Improving in that area.
I've already said that there's some sample size issues here, but I mean, look, yeah, we have the data we have, and that data looks good. A couple other things about the pace, like I've noticed a bunch. On misses and turnovers, you could just see in LeBron's eyes that he's like, all right, let's go. Like, he is sprinting down.
He's turning on the jetpacks off of misses, especially.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's fun to watch. Like, I get this, like, sort of, like, feeling of excitement in my stomach whenever I see that. It's fun. And even on the ABC broadcast, they did a little segment on it. And, yeah, you can see when, like, LeBron is in that sort of full, like, recoil, like, getting ready to sprint down. And yeah, I mean, he's a monster. The sort of, I don't know, the best example from the Spurs game was that layup he had against Patty Mills. Mills tried to foul him,
right,
and just sort of bounced off of him like a bowling pin. It was it was sad. I felt bad for Patty Mills.
Yeah, I mean, there was nothing he could have done at that point. He should have just not fouled him.
Yeah, I think another thing with the pace is, so if the Cavs are pushing harder in transition, I think you would expect the pace to... maybe, look, it's not going to, like, you know, suddenly go up 10 possessions per game, but I would expect it to go up a little bit because of that. I think one of the mitigating factors in the small sample we have is that the fourth quarters have been sort of blowouts.
Exactly. So in the fourth quarters, they intentionally try to keep it slow.
Yeah. Particularly, I noticed it in the game against the Spurs. It was sort of the Kyrie isolation show, which typically I would not be a fan of, but holy smokes, did it work on Saturday night.
Yeah, he was... He was doing pretty well against David West and LaMarcus Aldridge.
Yeah.
You know, with the zone, though, I don't think the Spurs should have gone to the zone because they missed out a lot of rebounds, especially. So that's one of the problems with the zone, right, is that people are caught out of position and you give up offensive rebounds. And if you looked at the rebounding discrepancy, the Cavs had like 11 more rebounds than the Spurs did in that game, which is a lot. I mean, if you think 11, that's 11 extra possessions the Cavs got. And they were also scoring efficiently. So there was no way
Yeah.
Spurs could have pulled that out.
Yeah, the Spurs sort of got behind the eight ball early. And
Yeah.
I mean, look, LaMarcus Aldridge was got three fouls in the first, whatever, 6 minutes or something
Right,
ridiculous.
and then he wasn't rebounding well either. He had like two rebounds by the end of the game,
Right.
which is
He's
ridiculous, I
not,
think, for.
I mean, he's an average rebounder. He's not particularly well known for his rebounding. But yeah, I mean, whoever comes in after him, especially with Duncan out, creates a situation where, yeah, they don't have good rebounding.
Yeah, I read somewhere that when Kevin Love is on or Cavs are like grabbing 80% of their defensive rebounds, so that's up there. That's one of the best in the NBA. Oh.
Okay, well, so let's move on to Matthew Dellavedova. Unless, is there anything else you want to say about the Spurs?
No, I think that was pretty good. Oh, actually, I have a question for you. Who do you
Alrighty.
think felt the worst after that win? Do you think it was the Spurs fans or the engineers who came up with that stupid lighting technology?
Yeah, so for anyone who didn't watch the game, ABC was piloting a new technology where they were supposed to be lighting up the three-point line. I don't know how it was supposed to work because whatever it was supposed to do, it didn't do, but I think it was supposed to light up the three-point line while the ball was in the air on a three-point attempt. Did you see it work at all?
No, I had to squint really hard for. I think I saw it once when they mentioned it, but like it required a lot of squinting. It really affected my vision.
Yeah, I think it just basically wasn't working. Yeah, I mean, I've worked for dot coms in the past where there's like sort of a big technology launch, and you work for it for months or weeks, and you're all excited, and then yeah, to have that happen is not good. But yeah, the Spurs. I mean, look, we thought we had a bad week a couple weeks ago when we got blown out by the Warriors and then ultimately fired our coach. Yeah, the Spurs got blown out by the Warriors and Cavs, the two teams that they're ostensibly better than. Yeah, rough week for them. Yeah, brutal. Anyway, all right, so Matthew Dellavedova. So, to my eye, he's been playing significantly better this year, so I wanted to do some digging into the numbers for him. So, per 36 minutes, oftentimes you'll see players' stats quoted per 36 minutes because, if a player plays only 15 minutes, obviously his points per game are going to be lower because he's not in the game for as long as somebody who's playing 35 minutes. So just to make sure I was comparing apples to apples, Dellavedova is indeed playing more minutes this year. I pulled up his per 36 stats. And while he has improved sort of across the board there, there's nothing here that's, sort of overwhelmingly screams awesome. His points per 36 have improved from 8.3 to 11.3. His assists have improved from 5.3 to 6.5. His rebounds are the same, 3.3 to 3.4 this year. His turnovers are actually up a little bit. He was 1.6 turnovers per 36 minutes. This year he is 2.0 turnovers per 36 minutes. So all of those things are, sort of modestly improved. His usage has gone up a little bit too. He's gone from 12.6% to 15.4% usage. So while he's on the court, he is responsible for more plays. His free throws have mysteriously gone from 73% last year to, are you aware of this? He's shooting 90% from the field this year.
I know. I did hear that.
I mean, he only shoots like a little bit over one free throw a game. So, some of that is sample size, but 90% is 90%.
Yeah, it
I've
never
no
made sense to me why he wasn't a good free throw shooter because he was an ex. It never makes. Okay, it's never made sense to me why anyone can be an excellent 3-point shooter but not be a good free throw shooter.
Yeah, there's some
There's a
guys.
handful of people like that. So Richard Jefferson has been traditionally one of those people. Where he would consistently shoot about 36, 37% from 3-point range, but only be in the 70s from
In
free
free
throw
throw.
line. And it was the same
Yeah.
for LeBron when he was at the Heat. He was shooting consistently above 37, 38% from 3-point, but he's always been a 72, 73% free throw shooter.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is it's a different motion, right? So like a three is, well,
Right, right.
for everyone except LeBron is normally a jump shot. And so it makes sense to me that like the percentages are different, but it does, yeah, I agree. Like how can you not shoot 80% from the line if you're shooting over 35% from three?
Right.
Yeah, it's sort of mysterious. One more thing on Dellavedova's free throws, like why doesn't LeBron let him shoot technicals?
Now he's been letting. I think I've seen him do it recently.
Oh, has he? Okay.
So at least for this game, David West got that technical early on, right?
Yes,
On
yes.
Kevin Love, on like the first possession or something.
Yeah.
And Kyrie shot that one, so
Yeah, well, he's,
that was a
yeah.
good sign.
LeBron lets, for whatever reason, he has, routinely let Kyrie shoot free throws. But if Kyrie is off the floor and Dele is on the floor and LeBron is also on the floor, so I'm creating a little bit of a strange situation here, LeBron will shoot the tech instead of Dele. Maybe that'll change going forward, but that
Hopefully
was
it's
just
just
like a
the
little.
regular season thing where he wants to practice it,
Yeah,
and
perhaps.
come playoff time, it's not going to be a thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's two downsides to that. The first is LeBron is not as good of a free throw shooter as Matthew Dellavedova, and the second is, especially on the road, when LeBron misses a free throw, I think that gives a little bit of momentum to the other team. But whatever, I'm nitpicking a little bit here. The big change for Dellavedova is, well, we're getting into, sort of advanced stats here. So his true shooting has gone from 49.3 to 55.4, and you'll occasionally see people on Reddit or forums across the internet saying like, oh, well, that's quote unquote only 6%. A 6% change in true shooting is an
Huge.
enormous change. I mean, he has gone from basically the low side of mediocre to getting up into elite territory for a point guard. His RPM, his real plus minus has also changed substantially. So last year, amongst point guards, he was 34th in the NBA with a negative 0.6 real plus minus. This year, he is 15th in the NBA with a 0.87 real plus minus. So, sorry, for point guards, 15th best point guard by RPM. So, I mean, look, for starters, there's 30 starting point guards that he is, competing with there. Yeah, and 15th best is, for a guy that we're basically paying the minimum, is an incredible turnaround. I mean, did you expect this to happen for him, Arnav?
No, I did not. I mean, I expected his 3-point percentage to go up because he's always been a pretty good shooter, and he had more time to practice. I expected him to shoot better on like floaters and stuff, which he's been doing. But I think what's been amazing to me is how he can run an offense now.
Yeah.
That's the craziest part. I mean, he has one of the best assist to turnovers ratio, especially from the bench. He has excellent effective field goal percentage off of passes. So basically, SportsView tracks what percentage people shoot at once you pass to them. So on the Cavs, the best is actually LeBron, and the second best has been Kevin, and third has been Dele, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean it's sort of incredible like that this has happened, but like Dellavedova's RPM is up 1.47 from last year, and he's playing more minutes, and that's yeah, like I was very skeptical after the NBA Finals that Matthew Dellavedova was going to be a long-term contributive player in the NBA, but I mean I told you this last week, like my hot take is I would not be surprised if Matthew Dellavedova is an all-star in 2 years. I mean,
The
he's.
problem with that, though, is that he doesn't have a usage rate where it's going to get him there.
Yeah, so that
And especially,
assumes.
we're not going to trade any of these people. Like, Kevin, Kyrie, and LeBron are here for a while, so.
In this universe, he obviously would have to be starting. I can imagine long-term moving Kyrie to shooting guard and having Dellavedova play point guard, but who knows? I mean,
Yeah,
we'll
I
have
can
to
see
see.
that easily.
But of course, yeah, like obviously Dellavedova would have to be starting. The Cavs have him for one more year. Well, he'll be a restricted free agent after this season. So I suspect he'll be back. He might be prohibitively expensive, especially depending on what the Cavs decide to do with Mozgov or any other players. But
Pretty
look,
sure Mozgov is gone after the season.
I think so too. And especially if it's a choice between Dele and Mozgov, I'm confident management will make the right choice there, and the right choice would be Dele. I did look up a couple more things. So let's see. Okay, so he is shooting fewer threes as a percentage last year. So last year, 54.4% of his shots were threes. This year, 45.7% of his shot are threes. And that sort of makes sense based on what you just said. He has added that sort of floater to his
Loader,
game.
yeah.
And that floater's done two things. Thing one is it's a good shot, and he shoots it at a decent percentage. Thing two is that it, because he is good enough at it and teams are scouting that he's good enough at it, it's opening up that alley-oop. So his
Right.
favorite alley-oop target is Tristan
Tristan.
Thompson. Last year I saw an interview with Tristan where he said that they call that alley-oop the Commonwealth because Tristan is Canadian and Delapetova is Australian, and I love that. I really want that meme to catch on. I'm going to do my best to bring that up as much as possible. But yeah, and it also, he gets alley-oops to Mozgov as well to a lesser extent. But yeah, that play is incredible. So to that end, last year, let's see here. So last year, from less than 8 feet, Dellavedova took 57 shots from less than 8 feet. So eight feet or closer. Last year, he was 16 of 57, which is 28% from less than 8 feet. This year, he's already taken 84 shots from less than 8 feet. He is 43 for 84 for 51.2%. So that alone, I mean, that's let's see, four. That's like a like 23% increase. From inside 8 feet, and when you combine that with like he's basically tripling his volume from in there, he's good, man. Like he is shockingly good.
Yeah, so I think, and plus on top of that, you have the net added benefit of Tristan being open for the lob or this, because people are gonna have been noticing that he's increased his volume and increased his percentage. Then the net benefit of simply just adding a floater is amazing.
Right, yeah, the synergy there between like the improved floater and that improved floater makes people respect that, which opens up the thing he was already good at, which is alley-oops. I mean, it's good
It's the
news.
same thing with threes, right? I mean, that's why you shoot a high volume of threes so that people can at least respect you from that range
Yeah.
and open up lanes for you.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. Two other things. One of them is on the topic of threes. One is just sort of funny. So in Matthew Dellavedova's 3-year career, he has never made an alley-oop. I'm trying to remember if I have seen him dunk. Have you seen Matthew Dellavedova dunk?
I heard there was a rumor that he did it in practice. I don't know.
Okay, well, you can get an alley-oop even without dunking. You just have to catch the ball in the air and lay it in without landing.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna look, I don't know anyone at the Cavs, but maybe if we talk about it on the internet, the Cavs will listen and the Cavs will try to run a play to get him and
I mean,
hit
we
him an
saw Kevin Love
alley-oop.
do a reverse alley-oop dunk in the playoffs, so anything is possible.
Yeah, if you would have given me odds on that, I think I would have taken 100-1 against, and I would have lost that bet.
The weird part is Kevin Love, his combine numbers, he was actually pretty athletic.
Yeah, and you would think with his, recent weight loss that, he would play above the rim more. But, well, anyway, all right, we're going to get into Love in a second. But one more thing on Matthew Dellavedova. So, a lot of times, role players who shoot a lot of threes, you'll see that they shoot a large percentage of them from the corner. That is not the case with Dellavedova.
He's above the break threes.
Yeah, he shoots a lot of above the break threes. And in fact, this year he is shooting a higher percentage from above the break. So he's shooting 39.8% on corner threes. And he's shooting 42.7% on non-corner threes. So that's a pretty high rate for above the break. In fact, that might I didn't look. That might be one of the best in the NBA. In fact, I strongly suspect it is. However, that he's only quote unquote only shooting 39.8 from the corners. You can imagine. Last year he shot 49% from the corners. Like you can imagine his 3-point rate being even higher as his, corner rate sort of regresses to what it was last year.
Right. So what percentage did you take from corner last year? Do you have that number?
Let's see here. Last year he shot 48.6% from the corner. So
48.6% field goal percentage, or
oh, actually,
48.6%
hold
of
on
the
a second.
shots were
Hold
from the corner?
on. I have this in my document here. Yeah, sorry, you're right. That is the percent that he took from the corner. I don't know.
Yeah, so I think
I actually don't
that's
know.
what I
I
wanted.
didn't write
So
it down.
what percentage did he take from the corner? Is he taking from the corner this year?
It was close. So I remember both seasons about he was about 50-50, so he shot 50% from the corner and 50% from above the break. I don't remember it, I didn't write it down, but I think the reason why I didn't write it down is because it was basically exactly 50-50 both seasons. So the breakdown of his threes hasn't really changed, but his make rate from the corners has gone down 10%. And
Yeah, so I think that's pretty optimistic because that number seems kind of fluky at this point. So
right, exactly.
that number should go up.
Right, everybody shoots better on corner threes because they are closer to the
They're
basket.
much closer, yeah.
And most
Also,
people don't bank in
for
threes,
some reason
so.
I thought he doesn't shoot that many corner threes because it always seems like Richard Jefferson is there or someone else is going to be in that corner because it's a much easier shot. But who
Right.
knows? Yeah.
Right. So I actually, all right, I actually do have like one more thing, a couple more, well, one more set of data on Matthew Dellavedova, and then we can move on. So I looked up his per possession rates. So NBA.com shows per team possession while you are on the floor, what percent do you score on, what percent do you assist on, what percent do you steal on. He has improved in scoring, assists, steals, free throws attempted, and personal fouls have dropped. His scoring, last year he scored on 11.4% of the time while he was on the floor. Now it's 14.5. Assists went from 33.5 to 37.9. Steals, 13.0 to 18.5. Free throw attempts from 5.8% to 6.8%. And personal fouls, and this one was really interesting to me, is down from 26% of the personal fouls while he's on the floor were him, and now it's down to 19.7. Dellavedova has always aggressively fouled people in the open court if he thinks that the opposition has a breakout, and I think that's something he does that's very heady and very smart. But he's still doing that this year, and his rate has dropped, and I think that's, I mean, look, he's just better all around.
Yeah, I mean it's not even that close anymore to
Yeah,
what he
I'm
was last year. I mean he's significantly better. He's probably one of the bottom half starting point guards statistically anyway.
Yeah, it's exciting. I mean, he's so young. Like he can, there's so much time for him and for him to improve. I mean, he's 3 years younger than Steph Curry. I think good times are ahead for Matthew Dellavedova. But anyway, all right, enough on him and my, love fest with him. Let's talk about Kevin Love a little bit. So, you want to kick that off?
Yeah, so one of the things with Kevin Love is, I mean, a lot of people have been focused on his shooting slump. So there are some fluky things about that shooting slump, right? So he's been shooting, what is it, 45% from near the basket. So that's a horrible field goal percentage for a big man near the basket. But the optimistic thing here is that traditionally he's never shot below 60% from that range. So this seems kind of a fluky thing, and maybe he's being hesitant because of his recent shoulder injury. But that's something that I don't think is going to be this bad for a while.
It seems unlikely that his true skill level has decreased 15%
Right,
near
I
the
mean,
basket
near the basket.
in one
There's no way that's
offseason.
possible.
Right, I agree.
From my eye, it seems like he's not using the backboard as well, and he's just trying to lay it in. But anyway, that
I
or
haven't
be
noticed that, but that's an interesting theory.
right. And on but the other side, the flip side of that is he was shooting much better from 3 to 10 range. So that's that hook shot that he kind of has mastered this season, which he didn't really have last season. So for those who don't know, he's been one of the most efficient post scorers in the NBA this season. And one of the main reasons for that is that hook shot that he has.
I mean, it's interesting. I noticed early on that he was taking the hook shot more. And look, the listeners don't know this, but you obviously do. I have a strong anti-Kevin Love bias, and maybe we'll get into some of those reasons why. But I worry that he is not as good as advertised. And I remember thinking, I was seeing that hook shot a lot early, thinking like, oh man, this is dumb. Like, why does he keep taking that? It's not a high percentage. Turns out I was like completely wrong, and my subjective bias was like, tainting my view here. But yeah, like he is, yeah, I mean, it's an elite tool for him. He's, I think, the best in the NBA at making those close hook shots.
Yeah, so one thing though, he's really smart about who he takes that hook shot against. He doesn't try it against someone who can actually defend it well. So he only tries it against mismatches, which is, in
Right,
my
yeah, he's not
opinion,
gonna. It's not gonna be useful against,
like
Duncan
Tim Duncan, right?
or
But
Hassan Whiteside or DeAndre Jordan, but against, the also-rans that most NBA teams have, at center and power forward, it's a devastating tool.
right. And then also, yeah, in general though, he's very smart about when he takes that hook shot. He's very smart about how he gets positioned in the post. And he's also a really good passer. I think people underestimate his passing ability. So one of the things is that he was known for in Minnesota was his passes from the elbows. And we hadn't seen much of that last year. So if you look at the number of elbow touches he got in Minnesota, that number was above 11. That's a huge number. And that regressed to 3 in his first year in Cleveland. In his second year in Cleveland, that number was at 4, which is better. But now since Tyronn Lue took over, that number's been at 6. So it's almost doubled since last year.
Wow. That's interesting. Okay, does that include the Spurs game?
So it includes everything from that Bulls game, basically.
Six feels about right to me.
Yeah, because he's not going to get 11, right, with LeBron and Kyrie. But about
Right.
6 to 7, I think, is sort of the range where he should be at.
Huh. That's really interesting. Yeah,
Yep, elbow
that.
touches have gone up. His true shooting percentage since Tyronn Lue took over is 62, so that's
Oh my
amazing.
gosh. Yeah. If he can maintain that, they should, etch your name on the championship trophy right now. Yeah, that's an incredible true shooting percentage. Do you think that hook shot is not usable against elite defensive centers is How does I, yeah, how much should I let that bum me out since both the Warriors and the Spurs have an elite defensive center?
Yeah, I don't think it's that useful against elite defensive centers, but I think it can be pretty useful against, Draymond Green has a really low center of gravity, which basically means that he can kind of maintain position, and he's also fairly athletic, so he can jump really high.
Yeah.
So it's going to be hard to use it against him, but if they can force a switch from Draymond to, say, someone like Klay or Harrison Barnes, he can definitely use that.
You
And the
also.
Warriors switch pretty frequently because they're all really good defensively and they're all very athletic. So they're
Right.
very confident in their defensive one-on-one defensive ability.
Yeah. Love has 2 inches on Draymond. I think Draymond is 6'7".
Yeah, Love is like 6'9", six,
Yeah,
six,
listed at
eight,
six
okay,
nine
so
anyway.
he's lied about his height a lot. He's not
Yeah.
6'10" or
Yeah,
6'11", but
but it's always hard to do this because like everyone lies about their height in the NBA and
right.
they don't get
He's about
measured.
LeBron's. He's like half an inch taller than LeBron. If you look
That's
at
right.
their Team USA photos, he
Yeah.
has maybe like half an inch or 1 inch on LeBron.
You forensically analyze pixel by pixel the Team USA photos.
I mean, they're
Yeah,
actually standing vertically, right? So that's like one of the only times where you can tell
Right. Yeah, but
how tall they
maybe, you know,
actually
the
are.
LeBron shoes have an extra quarter inch or something.
It's possible, yeah.
Well,
You
anyway,
never.
okay. I think also you were telling me yesterday a little bit about Kevin Love's defense and, how he shapes various Cavs defensive lineups.
Yeah, so with Kevin Love defensively, he's bad. He's pretty bad in the pick and roll. He actually rates in like the bottom 30% of NBA players in the pick and
How
roll.
is that? How is that quantified?
How is that quantified?
Yeah, is that from the SportsView data
Yeah,
or
so that's from the
okay.
SportsView data. So basically, they look at off the pick and roll if someone is either shooting or rolling to the basket. What is their field goal percentage when guarded by Kevin Love, and what is their field goal percentage otherwise?
Okay.
And they essentially put him in a certain percentile, and he ranks like 35, 36 consistently. So that's pretty
Okay.
bad, obviously. But everyone
Yes.
knows that. Everyone knows Kevin Love is not good in the pick and roll. Everyone knows Kevin Love is not good when he gets switched onto a guard, which, by the way, should never happen. But if it does, that's a bad thing.
Yeah, well,
On the other
happens
hand,
too
Kevin
much
Love
with
is actually.
Kyrie.
Sorry?
Happens too much with Kyrie. But yeah, sorry, go ahead, continue.
Yeah, so with Kevin Love, though, he's actually a fairly good post defender. So I don't know if you guys saw this, but even in the Spurs game, when he had David West on him or LaMarcus Aldridge, he did everything that he needed to do. Of course, LaMarcus made some tough shots, but he always does that anyway. So he always kept his position. He maintained his hands up. He didn't overcommit, and he also maintained verticality. So he did everything you were supposed to do in that situation. So
Yeah,
if
I
you
remember the announcers were talking about, oh, they left Kevin Love on an island down in the post against, LaMarcus Aldridge. And I remember thinking, I actually feel the exact opposite. I felt like Kevin Love played that possession. Look, LaMarcus Aldridge scored on that play. They were showing the replay. But I thought Love maintained his position. Like he, didn't give up anything easy. And yeah, LMA made like an amazing shot. Like that's not bad defense. You have to like
Exactly, yeah.
trust the process.
And then the thing is, he's also a much better post defender than Tristan Thompson. The problem with Tristan Thompson is his timing is just terrible. Like, I don't know if you saw it in this game, but LaMarcus and David West, or like, and Boris Diaw were just eating him for lunch.
I did notice Boris Diaw a couple times on Thompson, and it was ugly.
It's so easy to get past him in the post. It's all you need is one drop step, and he just either overcommits or just stays there and jumps too late.
Yeah, we should dig into Thompson a little bit more in another episode, but he's a good athlete. I mean, he's young, and I think there's a lot of room for him to improve.
No,
But
he'll be
yeah,
fine. Yeah, I'm not worried about him.
that particular thing right now is not his strength. That thing being defending, big people in the post.
In the post, yeah. But he's really good at the pick and roll, so he
Yeah.
kind of compensates for any other. He's really good in switches. He's really good at defending people off of the pick and rolls, which again
Yeah.
makes sense.
So I haven't noticed, but so the Cavs are now starting Thompson and Love. Do the Cavs put Thompson on the opposing center?
Yeah, most of the time, yeah.
You would think it might be better to put him on whoever the better shooter, well, whoever the person that is more often setting the picks for the opponent is, so that Thompson ends
Right.
up high, switching on pick and rolls, and Love stays down low, defending people in the post.
I
Uh,
agree.
I
Yeah.
suspect they're doing that, but I'll keep an eye out for that. And
The
if they're not,
problem, though,
that.
there is that Kevin Love isn't a rim protector either. So you're left
Yeah.
with that problem. But he's okay there. I mean, he's below average. But Tristan Thompson isn't some amazing rim protector either, so that's the issue. He's
Yeah, I
improved,
mean,
though.
I think the Cavs being an above average defensive team is never going to start with Love and Tristan. It's going to start with, LeBron and JR and Shumpert and hopefully and Dellavedova and hopefully Kyrie improving. And then, the bigs will be sort of around 50th percentile in defense. And when you combine, the elite guards combined with, the sort of average bigs, you're going to have like a very good defensive team.
Right. So I think with Love, that's an important point you bring up, is that a lot of people think that Love is a huge liability defensively, but the numbers just don't support that fact. I mean, all the best defensive lineups that the Cavs have actually feature Love in there, which means he might not, which obviously does not mean that he's contributing to that defensive juggernaut, but it also means that he's not being a liability. And that's, I
Right.
think, the main thing to take away from this is that you don't have to hide Love defensively, but at least he can keep it at the same level. He's not going to make you much worse.
Yeah, I mean that's to me like again like I have a anti-Kevin Love bias. That is a shocking finding to me. Like I would have thought for sure the Cavs are better with Mozgov and Tristan on the floor defensively than they are with Love, but yeah, I mean that's not the case.
I mean, you can look at his on-off rating. So if his
No, I
on,
mean it's
yeah.
incredible. I mean that's really encouraging, actually. I mean it's encouraging for two reasons. One, I think Mozgov is going to be gone, and it means that Mozgov's issues on offense. Previously, I would have thought that the Cavs give up a lot on defense without Mozgov, and so it's really a bummer that Mozgov isn't playing well
That's
defensively.
changed, yeah.
But if Love is not significantly worse than Mozgov, or indeed better, then it makes it so that Mozgov is basically expendable. And the Cavs seem to be playing lineups that indicate that Mozgov's minutes are dropping still.
Right. So I think the thing with Love is, though, that obviously there are certain plays in the fourth quarters that typically get highlighted where he gets either left on an island or, where he gets caught in a pick and roll and he can't recover. So that's where his reputation comes from, which I think it's fair. I mean, obviously he has a lot of issues that will pop up in fourth quarters against elite teams, but I think that's it's on the Cavs lineups and it's on the Cavs coaching staff to cover up for him because he's still, again, elite offensively and he can give a lot there. So
Yeah, I mean, I agree with basically everything you said there. The narrative on Kevin Love is that he is unathletic and not good defensively. I think that narrative, statistically, is incorrect. And because Love often ends up on the wrong side of highlights, that furthers the narrative more than what the statistical reality is. So,
right.
yeah,
I mean,
it's
for all his
encouraging stuff.
defensive deficiencies, he's his teams have always been better defensively with him on the floor. I mean, even in the Spurs loss and the Warriors loss, it looked pretty bad. Everyone, you could easily imagine how you could easily predict that the Cavs would be much worse defensively with him. But again, the numbers didn't support that. The Cavs had a defensive rating of like, I don't know, 120 something with him and 150 without him. It was ridiculous.
Wow. Yeah, I mean that's sort of bad and worse,
Right,
but
it
yeah, I
is
mean
bad and
the
worse, but
point
it
is
also doesn't mean
they are
worse
not
than.
worse defensively with Kevin Love on the floor, and that's like a really surprising discovery,
Exactly.
to me
But
anyway.
he gets caught in highlights, so
Yeah.
people go crazy over that, but whatever.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap up. This has been episode 3 of Cavalytics. You can email us at cavalyticsnba@gmail.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at cavalyticsnba. We'll be doing these at least a couple times a week, so we will be back very soon.